Next lecture will be by Brian Quinn, also from Texas. The title is Quantum Star Graphs and Related Systems.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to come here and speak at this very, very nice and I think very successful conference. And I'd also like to thank the audience for staying until so late in the conference to listen to my talk. I'm from Texas, but I'm not going to talk about vacuum energy. Instead, I'm going to take up a theme which has appeared in a number of talks previously, which is the theme of using quantum graphs as models for quantum chaos. And in this respect, I refer particularly to the talks of Sven Knutsman and Sampikos Kotos, who described very nicely some of the problems. I'll return to things that they have said already and also provide maybe some new material. In particular, I wanted to say, well, the reason that quantum graphs became studied in the context of quantum chaos initially in the beginning was to understand the universal spectral statistics that Sven talked about. Well, now, thanks to him and his co-workers, we do have a good route towards understanding this random matrix statistics that are appearing in the eigenvalues. And if one wants to look at where the new problems are in this, it seems clear to me that the next thing that people will use quantum graphs for in context of quantum chaos is to look at spectral properties of to look at statistical properties of the eigenfunctions. And certainly in the next quantum graphs conference, whenever it may be, I certainly will expect to hear more about this kind of work, since I know that there is very energetic researchers going on at the moment by a number of groups in these directions. So I will talk about star graphs, and they came up in a few talks, so maybe everyone knows what they look like, but in case someone does not, I found a picture of a star graph. It's this on the website. They're calling this a tritar, which is somehow a musical instrument based on star graph technology. It's like a guitar, but it has three ends, and in the center they're connected and a single central vertex. But just to be a little bit more general, I would consider star graphs that have a number of ones more than three, perhaps. And they are all finite, and let's say that there will be bonds. And I'll label the edges L1, L2, the lengths of the edges, and so on, LV. Now, like this. And I'm going to assume that I'm going to use the Kirchhoff conditions. At the central vertex and also at the external vertices, although actually what I'm going to say holds for general Neumann conditions as well. Most of what I'm going to say will hold for these general Neumann conditions. Since I'm going to look at eigenvectors, I will put some notation that I will use to describe the eigenvectors. Well, let's say the nth eigenvector I'll denote by psi superscript n. And it is a vector which gives you the component of the eigenfunction on each bond of the graph. So if there are v bonds, then it's a v-dimensional vector, and each component itself is a function. And I will use this kind of notation. So the superscript will be the wave number of the eigenfunction, and then the subscript will be the index of the number of the bond that this function lives on. And what I'm going to look for are eigenfunction eigenvector scars. And these were mentioned in the talk of Sampikos, but I want to also repeat some things that he said just to fix in people's minds what this problem really looks like. And I think these things are easier to visualize to start with in the case of billiards, and this is where the first observations of them appeared. So now I go back to quantum billiards, and remember, let me start with a classical billiard, which is some region in R2, it's called omega. And the classical motion of this is of a particle with hard reflections against the walls. So the particle bounces around like this. And of course, there are some periodic orbits. So in this case, this particle is in the stadium-shaped region, which is two semicircles and a square. And there is, for example, a periodic orbit which bounces backwards and forwards between these two ends of the billiard. The quantum billiard is the solution of Schrödinger equation inside this domain, which can be reduced to Helmholtz equation, with, let's say, Dirichlet boundary conditions. And, normalized to be one. In the 70s, when powerful microcomputers became available, it was possible to study numerically the solutions to this equation and look at what these eigenfunctions looked. So the eigenfunctions of Laplacian inside these domains, what they looked like. And I show a couple of pictures, or pictures like this. So these are the pictures you see are contour plots of the eigenfunctions of this this billiard. I think only positive contours are shown to give a cleaner picture, but you see certain different kinds of patterns. So here there is some kind of eigenfunction which looks like it's reasonably random without much structure. But what Heller observed was a number of states which had a greater intensity along some of the classical periodic orbits of the billiard. And for example, the pictures on the right are copies of the pictures on the left, but with the periodic orbit superimposed. So this eigenfunction seems to have much more intensity here compared to elsewhere, and also there is a more fainter trace of some intensity along this bow tie shape, which also corresponds to a periodic orbit. And the question, which remains a question even today, is, well, is this an effect of looking at some low-lying eigenstates? And that if you look sufficiently high up, they become much more regular, or like this top picture. Or can you find, say, for example, some sequence of these eigenstates, an infinite sequence in the spectrum, which the intensity does really concentrate on the periodic orbit?
It's no more question. Recent work by Stefano and Machel and Malini and Tarman, where they give a lower bound in the entropy, so it's no more question.
So
it doesn't exist.
So a question could then be, can you find an eigenstate which is a superposition of, say, some uniform distributed component and some component supported along this this orbit? And I will I will call such a construction a scarf. And it's not known if scars can persist in high energy limit. So of course the work of Stefan and Nalini has proved that it cannot be perfectly scarred, but maybe some component could be scarred. This is still open. Now we have some information about high energy eigenstates. Quite a powerful result, but which does not resolve this question, and is a quantum ergodicity theorem. So. Again, I will give the statement of some in the case of billiards, and which is due to Zeldich and Zvorsky in the most powerful case. If I have some region in which this classical ray dynamics are ergodic, then there is a subsequence of density 1, which just means that the number of terms in the subsequence less than some value divided by a value converges to 1. So a very, very dense subsequence such that if I look at the limit of the eigenstates in this subsequence, integrated against some test function, which you could think of as being, say, the characteristic function of some region inside this billiard, this converges to the average of the testing function. So what this means is that for this density 1 subsequence, which is almost all of them, the eigenvalues become uniform, like this top picture on this slide here. I will show a few more pictures. This is the slide which has appeared once already at this conference due to Arndt Bakker. And what quantum ergodicity theorem is saying is if you look at these pictures and you squint your eyes a little bit, they all should look more or less uniformly grey. Or almost all of them should look uniformly grey, except possibly for a subsequence of density 0, which could have some other behaviour. And it's along this subsequence of density 0 that we could possibly find this kind of scarred states. For example, here is one which looks like it could be part of a sequence converging to a scar, with this bowtie-shaped intensity here. But most of them look like this uniformly grey behaviour. These ones here with waves trapped between the two parallel walls are a feature just of this, the fact that you have two parallel walls in this billiard. If I took a billiard that did not have any parallel walls, then this kind of states could not be there. So we know that almost all of them don't scar; they become uniformly distributed. And what about those that don't? And more interesting to me, what can one say for quantum graphs? Well, there's a few things that we would have to get clear in our minds before we could formulate the analogous questions for quantum graphs. One is what would be the periodic orbits. But from the trace formula, we know what the periodic orbits look like. They should be just itineraries of bonds. So a scar for quantum graph could be just something which would localize on some itinerary of bonds. And here we have a theorem due to myself and Gregory Berkeleyko and John Keating of existence of scars for this star graph which I described at the beginning. And explain the main formula. So conditions are that the bond lengths are incommensurate. This is a standard condition in quantum chaos on graphs. Then for any pair of bonds that I choose, I can find a subsequence such that if I look at the average values integrated against some test function over the whole graph, along this subsequence this converges to just the average of the testing functions on the two bonds that I chose. So the intensity becomes concentrated along two bonds. And you may remember that in the work that Sampikos presented yesterday, he suggested that this kind of scarring was the one which would be most prominent in quantum graphs, that you could not get scars living along a single bond, so not a periodic orbit which bounces back along one single bond. This is ruled out. But the periodic orbit which bounces between two bonds certainly could be. Now, why is this such a subtle problem? Well, allow me to present a little bit of the history. This is certainly do not have space on a single slide for all of the possible contributions that people have made to this subject, but here are a certain number. So one of the first work on behavior of eigenstates of Laplace-type operators was done on Riemannian manifolds, and the quantum ergodicity theorem in that context was proved in the very beginning. First announcement was made by Schnellmann and work followed by Colin de Verdier and Steve Zeldich, who filled in the details. Then, in work slightly later, Rudnick and Sardak conjectured something which is called quantum unique ergodicity. And this conjecture is that for manifolds, this subsequence of density 1 actually should really be all subsequences. So there is no possible exceptions to this, no possible exceptional subsequences to quantum ergodicity. Then there was work done on quantum maps. Quantum ergodicity was proved for some quantum maps in 96. This quantum maps appeared in the talk of Professor Bogomolny, who gave a quantization of an area-preserving map of the torus. And for a different map, the Arnold Cap map, which is another chaotic map of the torus, there is a way to quantize such a map. Quantum ergodicity was proved at this point for the quantum maps. And then the recent results are two diverging results. Farrow, Nonamacher, and De Bievre proved that for these quantum maps, you actually could get scarred states, which, as our chairman pointed out, they are not scars in the perfect sense that all of the mass of the wave function concentrates on a periodic orbit, but half concentrates on a periodic orbit and half because uniformly distributed. But certainly is a violation of quantum unique ergodicity for this for this setup. And last year, in a very tour de force, Lindenstrauss proved the quantum unique ergodicity conjecture for a certain type of manifold, ones with a very strong arithmetical structure. So one sees here two different situations on manifolds and on maps where you have quantum ergodicity. So there are subsequences of density 1 in both these situations where you get equidistribution. But in one case, you can get scars, and in another case, you cannot possibly get scars. So this is, I think, the reason why this is quite a subtle problem. And let me come back to this at the end. Now, this is a quantum graphs conference, so I suspect that people here are interested in quantum graphs, but in case one is not, you might say, well, what does this have to say to me? There is a relationship between this family of quantum graphs, which I described as quantum star graph, and a family of quantum billiards called the Shaver billiards. And let me just describe what the Shaver billiard is. So Shaver billiard, in terms of physics, is something like a simple rectangle billiard, for example, together with a delta function scatterer at a particular point. Now, if you want to realize this mathematically, what you do is you look at the domain of Laplacian on this rectangle billiard, and you set all of the functions equal to 0 at this point, where you want to put the... Well, let me assume this was at the origin. You restrict it to class of functions for which this comes to 0 at this point. You make a self-adjoint extension. And you get... Hamiltonian Shaver billiard. And what are you doing with the quantum graphs? Well, as we learned at a number of points in the conference, you take individual graphs along each leg, and one way of constructing a quantum graph is to set them zero at the points where they're connected and make a self-adjoint extension. So to abuse pictorially, you take a set of individual legs and glue them together by self-adjoint extension, and one gets a star graph. And what it turns out that this means is that there are very deep relationships between this billiard system and these types of graphs. And often, if you can prove theorems for quantum graphs, you can prove something like an analogous theorem for these billiards using similar techniques, or at least the intuition you got from doing the quantum graph case, the star graph case, gives you some idea of how to proceed for the billiards. So I may put up here another slide. So shape a billiard as I've described, and what are we able to prove in this case? Well, this is joint work with John Keating again and Jens Marklov in Bristol and myself, and concerns quasi-modes of the shape a billiard. And I need to explain a little bit the notations that I'm using on this slide. So lambda is a quasi-eigenvalue, and the numbers j and these functions phi j are eigenvalues and eigenvectors or eigenfunctions of the rectangle. The eigenfunctions of the rectangle billiard without the scattering point added to it. So the things that you actually can solve quite easily for a rectangle case, you can find eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. And there are quasi-modes of the shape of billiard, which is just a superposition of two of these these eigenfunctions. And you can see immediately, based on this cartoon and the scarring result that I presented earlier, how this is an analogous setup, analogous result, since in this case you're taking now two bonds of the star graph, as you can think of as two of the unperturbed prior to the self-adjoint extension solutions living on two separate bonds, whereas here you have quasi-modes which are based on two modes prior to the self-adjoint extension of this rectangle billiard. And discrepancy here is the distance between the two eigenvalues of this unperturbed billiard. So if you look for a situation where two eigenvalues become close together, which we believe does happen, then you can get quasi-modes with low discrepancy. But a final comment that I want to make, and that goes back again to a slide with the history, is that we know quite a lot about these quantum star graphs. They have been well studied. Some work I have done on this and some work that other people have done on this. And there was a comment that was made in an earlier talk, but I forget which one, which was that star graphs are always counterexamples to everything. Well, that may be a strong statement, but we know for the star graphs that they do not fit into the regime where Sven Knutzmann can show that they have random matrix statistics. In fact, we know that their spectral statistics are not random matrix theory. They are something called intermediate type. But there are other other ways in which these star graphs behave very non-generically from what we expect a general quantum chaotic system to be. The random wave hypothesis, for people who know what it means, the random wave hypothesis doesn't hold for the star graphs. The quantum ergodicity doesn't even hold for the star graphs. These were also two results that I proved with John and Gregory and Jens. And as I said, the spectral statistics also are not of the generic random matrix type that you would expect. So what is the connection with the results that appear up here? Well, these catmaps and the arithmetic manifolds are also, in their own way, non-generic in this quantum chaotic world. And so what you will deduce from this is that there is no generic system that we can say for sure for which quantum ergodicity, the quantum unique ergodicity holds, or for which scars could be proved to exist. In all cases that we can say something concrete and mathematical, they are, for various reasons, non-generic. And the challenge, which I think is the challenge for the community, is to find a generic type system for which you could prove either that the scars do exist or that quantum unique ergodicity is true. And as I say, I think that this is the challenge for the future work, and we have some way to go, but there are a lot of interesting problems to pass through along the way. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, I have a question concerning this quantum scars and this quantum ergodicity. My recollection, since I also worked a little bit on this, is when you want to have quantum ergodicity, it's some sort of a semi-classical statement that means that in the limit of each particle, you have to assume that if you want to prove the limit theorem of this form, you have to assume that the corresponding classical system has ergodic properties, that you can prove it. And the question is here, I don't see, and this is also a question to the audience, I don't see what is the classical dynamical system that you can associate with this star graph. Do you have any idea?
Well, I have some things that I can say. I think that this is not completely understood. So what everyone takes to be the associated classical system for a quantum graph is the Markov process that you get by taking the unitary scattering matrix and taking absolute value squared of each component in this. This gives you a doubly stochastic Markov matrix, which can be thought of as a transition matrix of a Markov process. And when you want to ask what about ergodicity for quantum, for a classical analog of quantum graphs, you look at the ergodicity of this Markov process. Star graphs are a little bit interesting in this respect because they are ergodic in this sense. But as I said before, we can prove that they are not quantum ergodic. So quantum ergodicity theorem does not hold for this family of graphs, even in a semi-classical sense, in the sense that if you said, well, okay, for graphs, semi-classics corresponds to increasing number of bonds. If you look at an increasing sequence of these star graphs, you also don't get quantum ergodicity. So they're really non-generic. I mean, everything that you could hope to prove doesn't seem to be possible in these graphs. But in general, quantum ergodicity theorems, all the theorems that I've seen, that I know about, there is a semi-classical correspondence between this some quantum evolution, the classical evolution, which is in things like Egerov theorems. And for graphs, there is not, at least apart from in very special cases. You may talk to Gregory about some examples where it can be proved. But in general, the Egerov theorem, which connects the quantum and classical dynamics, isn't. We don't know what it should look like for quantum graphs right now.
I agree, except that it's not exactly a discrete Markov process, because you have the smooth dynamics, and when you go to the vertex, you have some choice.
That's right.
Okay. And moreover, as you said, the Egerov theorem is not true, because usually what you do, you apply the dynamics, you apply the pseudo-differential operator, and you go back. And you go back the same way. But here you don't go back the same way. There can be some interferences. So it's definitely not true, as it is not true in many systems. For example, if you take a billiard, you split into two pieces, and you take two metrics which are not continuous. You have a ray coming here, there are two possibilities, either refracted or reflected, and then you cannot have the Egerov theorem, and probably not.
But there are some families of quantum graphs which there is an Egerov theorem. And
which one?
Well, you may talk to Gregory Berkeleyko or John Keating or Uzi, who have worked on this problem, and they have a preview.
They can be weak versions of Egerov, which may be sufficient to prove
a quantum. The Markov process is a stochastic process, and it's a process involving the jumps from between vertices. I mean, it's very discrete. It's a very discrete process. But what we are talking about and what we are familiar with is that you have a classical Hamiltonian system with a phase space and some plectic structure, Poisson structure. And this classical system has to be isotonic. So this is what we know about.
But it doesn't work if we have something like that which corresponds to mode conversions. So there are, it's a quantum probability now. It's not classical probability. You cannot do that. Okay. Just there are some other questions. So just about the history. It's not correct that I am before Zeldic, because the first proof was by Zeldic for manifold with constant negative curvature, and my only addition was to show that there are some positive quantization in any cases. That's all. And I have just to ask the first people I meet, just. And by chance, I submitted it to CMP, which was much faster than Duke Mathematical Journal, and probably it's not 84, but 86 or something like that. Okay. But I suggest that we should call this result the Schnirelmann theorem, which is really because, in fact, all ideas are already in Schnirelmann's paper. So I suggest that to give the name of Schnirelmann to this result, which is probably the most convenient. Because after all, the idea is not at all trivial. That's the main part. So,
Thank you.